I think about value a lot, where value comes from. And if they're gonna, we consulting is, as I said, consulting is usually, right, kind of pricey. So the thing is that the only way that works is if we actually produce more value than they pay us. That's the only way it works.
Welcome back to TechWise, a podcast to help you feel less stressed and more focused to calm the chaos of consulting. Let's be inspired by the possibility that we can be happier by doing less in an industry obsessed with constant optimization. I'm your host, April Rest. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome back to the Tech Less podcast. I'm your host, April Rust. And today we have a special guest on, Charles Ackerman. Woo, woo, woo.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Charles.
How's it
Charles,
going?
Charles has made a career figuring out what he wants to be when he grows up, which I love that. A former film student, teacher, help desk manager, and project manager. Charles approaches problems the way mountaineers are always chasing the next summit. Naturally, when he turned to consulting more than 5 years ago, he never looked back. He currently serves as the regional head of delivery for North America with VRP Consulting. Welcome, Guilty. Charles. Guilty.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here. It's good to see you.
Hi, I love the intro. I love this part here about always chasing the next summit.
Thanks. Yeah. No, it's true. I think I just like to look at life as, I guess my goal is just to solve interesting problems in a nutshell and help people along the way. And, I think maybe as a kid that started from, maybe not the healthiest place, but, I think I've managed to turn it into something healthy. So, yeah, that's good.
Can you tell us a little bit about your path leading to consulting?
Yeah. So I'll start way back at the beginning, 4 billion years. No, I'm just kidding. I'm long-winded, but not that long-winded. So I grew up and I loved computers. I loved technology. And my dad got me a computer when I was in second grade, and I'll date myself a little bit here, right? In right around 1995, Windows 95. And that was sort of a big moment in, the history of technology. And I happened to be sort of the right, born in the right year, so to speak. And he said that was his retirement plan. Buying me that computer. And I thought that was kind of funny because as I grew up, I got really into it. And so I felt like, I don't want to spend my life, troubleshooting printers, because I didn't realize like how many jobs were out there in technology. And so I was like, I don't want to do that. And, in high school, I sort of had like a self-design major where I was really interested in writing, and I took sociology and philosophy and psychology and a course called Great Books and Ideas. And I wound up going to school to my undergrad to study film. And I realized I could pick up a degree in writing at the same time. So really very hippy dippy kind of stuff. I made movies and television and I had a blast. And I learned a lot about communication and presentation and all of that good stuff. And I graduated college right as the economy bottomed out. So that sucked in a big way. And then, I had to pivot. And I said, well, let me be a teacher, because I had connected with a couple of my teachers and they inspired me and meant a lot to me. And so I said, let's do that. So I moved down to Florida, packed up, all my stuff, which was basically just garbage bags of clothes, came down as a teacher, did that for like 2 years. And I loved it. I loved a lot about it. But for anybody that's in teaching or has been a teacher, there's a lot of challenges in that field. And so to sidestep a lot of different stories and rabbit holes, I said, I was looking for a change, and I got really lucky, and I was super fortunate because I found an opportunity to be an instructional technologist, And so after teaching technology, I actually taught TV production. So that was pretty neat. And then that's sort of an interesting natural jump to instructional technology and how do you integrate technology into the classroom. And I did that for about a year. And then I got promoted to actually be over help desk. And when they hired me, they said, "We didn't realize you were this technical. And if we had realized that, we would have, maybe actually not hired you for this job, but now that you're here." So I became the manager of a help desk and technology field support. And I was like, I don't know, 23, 24, 24, 25, something like that. And so I was actually introduced to project management by someone that, I actually kind of butted heads with a lot. And eventually I kind of came to have a good relationship with. But I felt, like I could see the value of project management. Mm-hmm. And I also at the same time was like, I need a piece of paper that says I know what I'm doing. Because I'm like, you can't escape your fate. I got pulled into technology. It was inevitable. So, I went and I did my master's in computer information systems. And my concentration was in IT project management. And so I started managing projects, informally. And then I got my first job as a full-time project manager. And then at a university, jumped ship from where I was. And then I did that for a while. And then actually it was one of my mentees that jumped ship into the realm of consulting. And at his sort of goodbye party, I had said to him, hey, I really enjoyed working with you. And I feel like you've kind of been my first like mentee. Because I barely know what I'm doing, but thanks for playing along. And I said, I'll follow your career with great interest. I always like to channel a little bit of Darth Sidious there. And then I said, let me know if there's anything that opens up that you think I might be a good fit for. Because I was kind of feeling like I was ready to move on to something else. And he said, actually, they're hiring. And I said, really? So the rest is history. And that's and I got into consulting, and it's just been. One project after another, and it's been a wild ride, and I love it. And I had the opportunity to take on a position where I get to oversee and work with project managers now, so I get to scratch that mentoring itch. Mm-hmm. And work with some really cool projects, and so when I say I like solving problems, it's a great job because I get to solve all kinds of people problems. I joke, working, and I'll say project management, project delivery. It's like you're 50% therapist, mm-hmm. you're 50% planner and organizer, and you're 50% whatever you need to be. And I'm well aware that adds up to more than 100%. So
I love that. I was waiting for
that's
it.
The
like,
job.
Wait a minute, that's 100. Yeah. Yeah, that tracks.
That's it.
That's why I'm so tired all the time.
Mm-hmm. You and me both.
What, I think you've been in consulting with 5 years, more than that, maybe now.
Since about 5 years, a little over 5 years. I guess we're going on five and a half. Yeah.
What do you think have been the most common challenges you've seen delivering projects specifically from the consulting side?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, as I think about my career and even where I want to go in the future, I think one of the challenges is honestly that, and I feel like this is maybe passing the buck, and I don't like to pass the buck, but honestly, I feel like one of the biggest challenges is that the clients themselves, I think, struggle to know how to really use consulting. Mm. And so what I mean by that is that, and this is not a knock in any way. It's more of just sort of, I think, an acknowledgement. Like I've dealt with a lot of clients that they don't know the difference between time and materials and fixed price. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's really, really big fundamental, difference. Now, on the other hand, I've had one or two clients that they actually, know the difference. Like, oh, we want to, an NTE, not to exceed, contract. And it's like, and I've had some people kind of get suckered into those, frankly. And it's like, those are, worst possible kind of contract you could possibly, you know, take on. So, you know, you gotta manage that. But I think a lot of it, you know, Sun Tzu said, I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna channel Sun Tzu. The battle is won before it's fought. And if your contract isn't right and your engagement structure isn't right, if you don't get those things right from the get-go, then you're just out. You know, it's like that old black and white movie where they're, you know, trying to work on the train tracks while the train is coming up behind them, and you're always trying to stay one step ahead, and it's just messy, and you want to avoid that. And so I think clients often don't. So that's sort of another closely related problem, I think. But, you know, ultimately as consultants, it's really our job to make sure we do a good job on that and getting the start of the engagement structured well. But you can do that. You can lead a horse to water, but I think sometimes clients don't realize, I mean, one, there's, I think there's some hard skills that sometimes they lack, you know, even some of the fundamentals of a project. What is the project scope, and how do, well, so one of the things I like to do in a kickoff, and it's so immensely uncomfortable at first, is just talk to the client about what your expectations are. You know, what do you need? I always like to go into consulting with the headspace of, we are not order takers. Mm-hmm. We are not here to just do what you tell us to do. This is, I mean, even legally, it's a business to business relationship. Almost, it's like if you go to the gym and you hire a personal trainer and you walk in, I tell this sort of little anecdote a lot. You know, if you go to the gym and you have a personal trainer, you walk in and you say to them, yeah, I want to lose 20 pounds and I'm going to go over there and I'm going to do a bunch of pull-ups and then I'm going to do a bunch of sit-ups and then I'm going to go, you know, have a smoothie afterwards. So show me how to use the machine. You know, a good trainer is going to look at you and say, stop, turn around, walk back out the door, come back in, and let's try again. And, you know, I think that's scary for a lot of people because, mm-hmm. you know, I've seen a lot of people on the vendor, you know, on the consultant side that, you know, feel like they have to, you know, bend over for lack of a better word. And that's, if you're doing that, then you're missing the point, because the point is the root word of consultant is to consult. And consulting means that to an extent you have to know better, you know, and you have to be the expert. They're hiring you for your expertise. And I mean, you know, Steve Jobs has a great quote, you know, I hire smart people to tell me what to do. And I'm a huge, even if you don't like Apple stuff, right? He's just a fascinating character to study. And his whole shtick is, you know, just get really good people. And whether if you're on the client side, you know, if you feel like you have to micromanage your consultant, then you probably need a different consultant.
Yeah.
But also, if you're finding that you're looking at them and you're finding that they're really smart and they're really talented and they know what they're doing and you trust them, then get out of their way. But that's true for any kind of, you know, relationship, I think, really is how do you empower the people around you. That's incredibly important too. But I've probably more than answered that question. I'm just digressing at this point. So
no, I like the I like hearing more about like what goes into the answer. I'm curious, like, if you could wave a magic wand. I know that being on delivery, we don't have too many magic wands in the pre-sale cycle. Oh, you've got one.
So I keep a couple of props on my desk in the background. One of them is a magic wand because I have occasionally, I'm holding up a magic wand. I've literally just been talking to a client, said, if you could wave the magic wand and have whatever you wanted, and I just hold up the wand, and then I've seen that just go completely flat and they don't notice it. And then I've seen other people just break out laughing. I think humor is important, but anyway, I'm sorry. It just,
no,
you grabbed
no.
me with that.
I love that. Yeah. If you could wave a magic wand, right? Like how would you approach the pre-sales process to gain that alignment and to gain, you know, to set those expectations to kick off the project, giving it the most probability for success?
That's a great and dynamic question. There's a lot of ways to answer that. I think, you know, foundationally, to my knowledge, I'm sure they're out there and I just don't know about them. You know, I haven't come across any, but, you know, I haven't, I don't think there's too many consulting firms out there that are nonprofit. And I say that because I think it's important to recognize that when you go into business and when you're trying to figure out if you're a good fit, if your company, whatever, you know, whatever kind of consulting you do, if you want to find out if you're a good fit as early as you can. And so I, you know, and that's ultimately because you want to make money, right? And so, and you wanting to make money has to align with your client's goals and it has to be win-win. And that's the thing. I, you know, consulting, you know, typically pays pretty well, and commands, you know, pretty high premiums. But the expectations are high. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to perform and you've got to be able to perform. And so, you know, if you could, if I could wave the magic wand, how would I try to make it, you know, more successful? I think it's recognizing that not every client is an ideal fit and that's okay. It's okay. You know, there's only one of you out there and that's true if you're selling your consulting services, whether you're, and frankly, I think of it as like, if I work for a company or if I'm a 1099 or if I own my own company and I'm selling services, it's all the same thing. You're always selling your services if you're truly a consultant at the core. And so you want to legitimately find out what is the client trying to do and can they be successful? And I think that's, I think that that last point in particular, can they be successful, is not something we think about often enough. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, signing a contract with a client from your perspective as the consultant, you're entering into a legal agreement. And if you don't think in your heart that you can actually get that done, if you don't think you can actually deliver and make good on that contract, well, then you're not credible. And our entire business is based on credibility. It's all about credibility. It's all about trust, because the client, you have to be a certain kind of person to walk into a room and say to a client, you should pay us $500,000 to navigate you through this enormous challenge and transformation that you want to do, or $1 million, or, you know, whatever the amount doesn't matter, right? We're talking about, you know, big numbers here, and they've got to believe that that money is going to be worth it. And sometimes, and that's half the battle. The other half the battle is actually making good on it, because it's not enough to just, you know, I've seen a couple of people that they're really good at selling the belief and they can't actually make good on it. And so I think, but if you focus on, you know, can we be successful here, right? If you're going into the client and you're, and you know what they need and you're confident about it, right? And they're just shooting it down or they're not getting it. I had a client once that we were struggling to find the right approach and I had gotten brought in on an escalation and, you know, I did what I could to help and we were trying to find a way to, you know, come up with a different approach that could work for them. So we're going to looking at different ways of working and, you know, different contract vehicles potentially as well. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, like do we want to go in like a managed services direction or, you know, there's all these different ways of tackling things and said, well, you know, let me educate you for a minute on just kind of how we work. Right. And so like, if you want to go in this direction and you want to check these boxes, you know, it's going to be a little bit cheaper, but this is what you're going to lose. but this is what you're going to get, right? On the other hand, if you got, you know, some, you know, if your budget's higher and you want a little bit, you know, more of this over here and you can afford that, then that'll be good. And I said, which of these things is stands out to you? Or does one of these options stand out to you? And that person said, you know, I don't really care. That's your problem. And, you know, right there, I said, we should close this deal because that's wrong. It's not my problem. It's actually not my problem. It actually is your problem as the client, because, you know, I could be a crappy vendor, right? Let's assume for a second, right, that I'm just like a bad actor here. How do you really know if I'm good or bad or whatever? Ultimately, right, like if I was in his shoes and I was running the business, I would say, well, I want to understand like how they work so that I know like what I'm getting. And I recognize that, you know, ultimately I'm going to be spending money on this engagement, mm-hmm. and that I expect to get a certain amount. One of the things is consultants put in, I think about value a lot, where value comes from. And if they're going to, you know, consulting is usually, right, kind of pricey. So the thing is that the only way that works is if we actually produce more value than they pay us.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way it works. So if you're on that side, right, if you're looking for a consultant, then, you know, you want to know how to maximize that value, because there are unfortunately vendors out there that will go in and they'll just say, yeah, whatever we can do to sign the deal, and they'll sign the deal.
Yeah.
And then in 6 months or a year or 2 years or 3 years, you can come back to me and you can add a zero to the end, to the original quote. And then maybe we'll talk about it. And I've seen that, and I've been that guy that's, you know, been the guy brought in to turn things around. So, I think it's important to always try to just do right by people.
Yeah,
that's it.
And something that you said kind of triggered a thought for me, which was finding out early if a client might be a good fit. And I think part of that is moving away from this thought that like we're going to stand up technology and mm-hmm. looking at these projects more so like, okay, well, what is the actual business value of this project?
Yeah.
And are we confident that we're going to essentially be able to guide this client to see the business outcome they're looking for?
Yes.
Because, you know, we might think we're being contracted to implement Salesforce, but when the client's team doesn't adopt it, and when they don't, you know, see the increase in revenue, they're going to be really disappointed, you know, with the relationship overall. And I just think like that for me is such a big part of, if I had a magic wand, I would want each and every person from pre-sales to that follow-up managed services engagement just to be so dialed in on like, what is the actual value of what we're working on, and how, like, how do we write contracts that speak to that? It's like, I don't have a good answer for that. I think it's really tough to write a contract that's value-based.
Yes.
Because it's so intangible.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard.
It is.
Finding that. But I just, and again, like, I don't have a good answer for this, for like, how do you actually take this theoretical concept of focusing on mm-hmm. value and execute on that in a way that the client says like, yeah, I'm willing to pay, let's just say $50,000 for a small project. Like, how do you ask someone to pay $50,000 when you don't necessarily have deliverables tied to that are tangible? You know, I don't have a good answer for that. It's just like, I see so much where people are so focused on scope and deliverable, and we lose sight of, is this even going to add value to the client?
Yep.
Anyway.
Well, no, I'd love to bite on that for a minute, because that's more or less what I'm all about. And so what I've learned and grabbed onto as I've kind of gone through my career is that, look, at the end of the day, everybody's got lots of stuff they want to do. And there's the great scarcity is time, more than anything. And if you want to make the most of that time or any resource, that's whether it's time or money or talent, you've got to know why you're doing what you're doing. You've got to know the big picture. And I'm constantly trying to communicate out to people. I feel like, in a nutshell, my job is, or one of the core purposes, goals, is to make sure that everyone has a clear understanding of the vision and why are we here? What are we trying to do? And so I always, and this is just a fun sort of management tip I like to throw out there to anybody that works. If you work with people, it's a good tip, right? Mm-hmm. Always say, this is what I'm trying. This is what we want. And this is what we don't want. And you always want to provide both. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of psychology, I think, that goes into that, and why that is, having to do with, you know, AI is all the rage. You know, now it's like, this wouldn't be a conversation set in 2024 in the consulting space if I didn't mention AI somewhere in here.
so true.
So if you want to go, but if you want to get into that, right, even how you build models at a technical level, it's like, it all comes in like, this is, you know, reinforcement learning is, this is what's good and this is what's not. And if you're like a kid, and, you know, cause here's the thing, if you give a good, clear vision, then, you know, people have something to move towards. But at the same time, sometimes it's easy to attach a goal to something and over-optimize for that goal. Great example is Ford set out in the 1970s to build a vehicle that could compete with the Asian cars that were coming in from mm-hmm. Toyota and Honda as they were sort of getting started in America. And they wanted to have a cheap car that was popular and, you know, had all these, you know, different features, and they went about building it and but it was like cheap and good. And that's what they wanted. And they succeeded at it. And it was a big success financially because they were selling a ton of them. And, but the problem is that safety wasn't a goal. And so the goal was, you know, to really maximize the profit and maximize the, you know, or minimize the price, you know, to the end consumer. So they saved a couple of bucks. It was only a couple of bucks they saved for every car that was built. It was turned out to be millions of dollars by not protecting where the gasoline was stored. And so these cars were the Pinto. I'm talking about the Ford Pinto, which were, they would be rear-ended and they would catch fire and burn people alive because safety wasn't one of their goals, right? So you always got to say, like, okay, you know, if somebody had just gotten in a room and they said, yeah, like, here's what we want. We want a car that's going to be cheap and competitive and, you know, high quality. But here's what we don't want to happen. This is the part they were missing. They missed the part. So what we don't want to happen is we don't want these cars to explode and kill the people inside them. Like that. So you've always got to have that. This is the good and this is the bad. This is what we want. This is the what we don't want, right? So I would like to get this presentation done, but I don't want to see you spend more than like an hour working on it, right? So it's like, oh, okay.
Yes,
like
yes,
this is the
yes,
sort of the
yes,
boundaries,
yes.
Right? So you set that stuff up front. And I forgot where I was going with that. I think maybe that in and of itself, though, is just, you know, I think incredibly important to you got to think all the way around. Oh, but it's about seeing the big picture,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you mm-hmm. can't, if you yourself are in a situation where you don't know what to do, you know, if I'm in a situation where I don't know what to do, the first thing I ask myself is, well, what do I want to happen? What does good look like? And what does bad look like? And I think they're both equally important. And we tend to only focus on one and forget the other, but actually you really need both. So I'm constantly just, and you want to make those short, tight little things that you can just throw out to people. You know, I think just the other day I said to somebody, you know, we're talking about sending out requirements to a client or something. They're mm-hmm. trying to give them Jira access. And I said, this is too much of a pain in the neck for the client. You know, this is, they're busy and they don't have access. And by the time they get access, it's, you know, I said, and anyway, I said, we need a memorial for this. You know, we need it to be memorialized. So we need a snapshot in time. So we need to export these. And, you know, they were going through this whole thing with like a PDF. And I said, you're overthinking it. You know, we don't want this to take more than 15 minutes. Look, if we have to have screenshot a bunch of stuff, that's fine. I said, you could PDF it. And then they got hyper fixated on the PDFing. I said, that was just an example. My bad. I didn't communicate that well. An Excel file is fine, right? Mm-hmm. As long as, you know, it's easy to send over, it's easy for them to use. And we don't want to spend a lot of time on it or make it difficult. This is what we want. This is what we don't want. You know, and then everybody was like, oh, good. Yeah, okay. And, you know, and then they ran off and then they did it. So if you give people a good, clear vision, then, you know, they'll take care of it. Mm. You know.
I love that though, of like, this is what we don't want. Because sometimes I think about that and sometimes I totally don't. And I think that would be really applicable.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, I'm sure our listeners, but also just for me in my own day-to-day work.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like on some of the projects where you've had an escalation, can you give an example of like realigning the team with, like,
yeah,
here's what we want and here's what we don't want?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I like to go in, you know, whenever there's an escalation. I mean, ideally, right, first is you're staying out far ahead enough of it that there's not an escalation. So you kind of see the problem coming. And usually I'm pretty good about, you know, explaining to, you know, anybody I work with, it's like, look, my goal is to avoid surprises. So, you know, help me do that. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, sometimes those things are a fact of life and we've all had them. We've, you know, I've been on both sides of escalations. And I think, I'm trying to think of a specific example, but usually I kind of approach that as talking to the client and first understanding what their perspective is and what did they see as the problem. And of course, I always, you know, I always like have that one-on-one or, you know, I let them gang up on me if they want to, but I go into that room and I just like to just ask questions and just go in with a spirit of curiosity and openness and vulnerability. And I do the same for whoever has escalated it to me and I get their perspective. And what I find is usually everybody actually kind of agrees on where the problem is. They just disagree on this, like the where it comes from exactly. You know, it's like, you guys are disorganized, right? And then it's like, you know, our side will be saying, oh, well, they don't know what they want. And those are really just, you know, different sides of the same coin. So then I actually like to ask the question of, okay, like, what do you guys want to achieve? And what does good look like? And then we'll talk through that. And then I'll say, okay, so what does bad look like, right? What are you trying to avoid here? And so sometimes that's the literal conversation. I will ask those questions literally. And other times you'll just kind of pick it up in the conversation. Cause I also don't like to like ask people to repeat themselves, but, and then sometimes what I'll do is I'll actually just state it back. And what I'll state back to them is, you know, okay, so, you know, I think what we want to do here is ... Or I think what we want to achieve here is this. We want you guys to have, you know, I'll say it back. Like, you know, it sounds to me like you guys need earlier and more proactive communication. You need communication that's simpler so that you know what we're asking and where you're stuck. And then usually what I want to avoid is the information that I got back internally. Right. So then internally, I'll say, so like what I want to avoid is going back and forth around the requirements for eternity. And it's not that we can't change the requirements ever, but right, it's the later we change the requirements and the bigger we change the requirements or the more we change the requirements, then the riskier, right, that is. Because obviously, if the day before we go live, you say all of a sudden you want a totally different system, throw it all away, then, you know, that's catastrophic, right? So that we don't want that, right? And so, you know, there's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and they talk about think win-win. And I think that there's sort of a nuance to the thinking win-win, which is part of that conversation should also be, it's not just what you both want to achieve, it's also what you both want to avoid happening. And so I'll say to the client, like, I've said to the client, like, okay, you know, we can do what you're asking, but my fear is this. And, you know, I just had to have a CO, a change order, you know, kind of conversation the other day with a client. And I said to them, you know, my fear with this change request is that we're going to be less flexible for you. And I think that one of the things we've done really well, and that's made our relationship successful, is that we can be flexible for you. So I want to make sure whatever we do, that if there is a loss of flexibility, that you know about it and you're okay with it. And that if you change your mind and you're not okay with it, that we can have that conversation. And so I think that, like, this all also kind of ties into that psychological safety thing, you know, which is, I think, just incredibly important. And if you just show people, and the way I'm talking to you, this is the way I talk to everybody. I mean, I talk to clients, and I feel like I can say stuff to clients that, you know, I've had people look at me and be like, I don't know how you said that to the client, like, or I don't know how you're going to communicate that to them. And, you know, I'll be honest, I'm not perfect, and I'm always a work in progress. But, you know, I used to be very conflict averse, and I realized, you know, I realized that I was very rarely surprised by something that went wrong. And that to me was a big indicator that there is a problem with me, because if I know better and I see the problem coming and I find myself in the problem and then I'm irritated, well, then why didn't I do something about it? Damn it. You know?
Yeah.
Damn it. Yeah, yeah. If I could have just, you know, said this, and there's a great book on the topic called Radical Candor, which is, I've read a lot of books on communication, you know, and there's a couple, if you're interested in this, if you're interested in this topic and you want some book recommendations, How to Win Friends and Influence People is the classic, you know, from Dale Carnegie. It's from like the 20s or 30s or something. That's a good one. Crucial Conversations, not really about communication, but 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I would put Radical Candor up there with all of them, honestly. And it's a pretty recent book. And the idea is this, is that we tend to think of communication as well, I can either be nice, or I can tell them what I think. It's one or the other. And that's actually completely false. You can actually have really difficult conversations and still come from a constructive place. You can fire people from a constructive place, right? You can reject people from a constructive place. And so I think that that's like a mind bending idea. But once you start looking at it that way, then really the whole world kind of opens up to possibilities, because you can think about, yeah, you know, I want to do this deal with you guys, but I'm concerned about the negative side, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is everybody has a right to doing what's in their own best interest. And that's a good thing. I don't really, if I don't know what somebody's self-interest is, I don't really trust them. I'll be completely honest. Maybe this is because I'm from New Jersey, but, I was like a good New Jersey joke, but, you know, I don't know where I grew up, you know, I felt like people were generally pretty, I'm in Florida now, but I felt like people were, you know, hey, you know, I gotta make my money. I gotta do my thing. You know, I gotta, you know, and everybody respected, you know, you're right. You know, everybody respect everybody's hustle, that's a good thing. And if, you know, if I'm not the right fit, then that's okay. You know, maybe I can help you find somebody that's the right fit. And that's bigger than all of us, right? It's like a way, it's like rules of engagement is the way that I think of it, is like, I'm okay if I'm not a good fit for a position, for a company, a client. I'm not everybody's cup of tea. And there are days where if I could get away from myself, I certainly would. I'm stuck with me, but
I had one of those days yesterday.
Yeah. Tell me about that. Tell me about that.
I was so irritated. It was no bueno.
Those days happen.
It was not good. Not even like a 20-minute Peloton ride could like fix me. Exercise usually puts me in a better state of mind, but I just was like, I'm going to bed, y'all, at like 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's just one of those days.
I've had some of those days too, my friend. And there's a good topic there, because self-care is important. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, especially if you're talking to, if you're in project management and project delivery, if you're, I mean, even if you're not, you know, this stuff, it's hard. It's complex and it's ever changing. And what I like about it is that no day is ever the same as any other day, but that also means you're going to have your ups and downs. And it's like also that it's a lot of hard work, a lot of toil, a lot of heads down, not a lot of glory. And, you know, sometimes for months on end, and then sometimes for years on end, and then you finally get to the destination and it's like you have this brief moment in the sun, and then it's just like, okay, well, now what am I going to do? I got to go find another gig. I got to find another client, another project, another whatever, you know, or maybe you've drummed up some work with the client as you go. And I'm almost every client that I've ever worked with, I've wound up, you know, drumming up more work because I'm just observant. And it goes back to that business value thing, because I like solving problems. So as I'm going through working through something with the client, I'll say to them, look, like, this may not be in scope now, but, you know, you've got something over here that you might want to do. It's kind of like somebody comes over, your, you know, contractor comes over, you're working on your kitchen, and they say, hey, you know, have you ever thought about doing this? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're an expert in your field, you see things that they might not see, and know things that they don't know, because we do this all the time. We do this for a living. They do not. And so if we have that to bring to the table, you know, I don't believe there's anything wrong in throwing that out there and saying, hey, maybe this is something you're interested in. And if they bite, they bite. And if they don't, they don't. Right. But
yeah.
And sometimes you got to plant seeds, and sometimes it takes a while for them to come to fruition. And maybe they don't even go with you as the vendor, or maybe you're, you know, that's it. But like, it's all good. You're putting the positive stuff out in the universe, and you're not going to, you know, land 100% of the, you know, shots that you take. But
right, yeah, I mean,
you know, the Wayne Gretzky thing, you miss 100% of them that you don't.
Of that you don't take, exactly. I did want to take us down the topic of working modalities and flow states, because I know you mentioned that before we hit record, and like creativity. And I'm curious, you know, I think it's been my experience, and I've heard this from a lot of people, especially doing this podcast, of like feeling like they have to be in front of their desk, you know, feeling like in front of their computer, like 8 hours a day, you know, maybe skipping a lunch or just eating while they were. Like, how do you approach the working modalities? How do you find flow? Like, what does that look like for you?
So going back to the big picture on this one, I think one of the potential sort of failings of our industry, of consulting in general, and I don't know the answer to this really, I think about it a lot, but I you know, if anybody has the answer, I'd love to hear it, is all hail the billable hours. And I think that it's very easy to lose sight of what we're really supposed to be doing. Because the problem with our work is it's difficult to quantify. Now, if you get into like fixed price contracts and you understand the value, and or even if you don't, even if you're just doing T&M and you're estimating the effort, right? I guess that part doesn't really matter. But if you're aligned to value, then, you know, you should be focused on the value, and you should be asking yourself, what's the most direct path to get to that value for our clients? And I think ironically, the billable hours thing is you know, it sort of is a perverse incentive to spend time being busy. But busy does not necessarily translate to success.
Or to value. Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you want to, you know, I've seen dysfunction where, you know, people would, you know, jump from project to project to project to project, you know, or status meeting to status meeting to status meeting. And they, you know, I mean, because here's the thing, right? You could be on 8 projects, you know, eight hour long status meetings a day, right? It's like a special kind of, like, it's a special kind of hell that I'm imagining.
I was
here.
Hoping that's what you were gonna say.
Yeah, it's like, it, if you've ever read like No Exit, yeah, like an old existential play, I think we read it in junior year in high school or something. It's like, you know, well, for this status meeting, I'm gonna sit in this call and I'm gonna say I haven't really done anything because I've been on meetings all day. You know, and then you go to another meeting. Well, I haven't really done anything because I've been meetings all day. And it's like, sometimes you look around and you say to yourself, like, what am I supposed to actually get work done? And so, you know, one is, if you're in a position where you have any influence over what meetings are occurring, for the love of God, do yourself and everybody else a favor and look at those strategically and ask yourself, you know, can we cut this? Because there's a great book on this topic I just finished reading a little while ago called Deep Work. And there's another book called, I think it's called Catching Fire or Stealing Fire. I'll have to send you links to these afterwards for anybody that's interested. But the idea is that, in a nutshell, there's a lot of psychology that supports the idea that if you want to do really good work, if you want to be a high performer at whatever you're doing, you need solid blocks of uninterrupted time where you are disconnected from any distraction and where you're immersed in a topic that is challenging enough to push you, but not so challenging that you're just spinning your wheels and struggling, right? And so if you can create the conditions where that can happen, and I truly think of it as, it's, I have to create the conditions. So I usually block out like a couple hours a day on my calendar. That's just for heads down time. And that is my time that I have really great sound canceling headphones and I put music on without lyrics. And I actually have a whole sort of office space set up. I'm going to be moving my home office into, I'm calling it the Flow Dojo. but it's all about this part of it. It's like, I have this sort of master closet we're redoing, and it's tucked away and nobody ever would walk by there because it's actually inside the master closet, and there's separate, it just so happens the geography, you know, of my house is where there's a pantry on one side and there's a master bathroom that you can't really get to, and it's and the other side is a, you know, cinder block. So it's very quiet, it's tucked away. And this is sort of a downside thing because I do believe sunlight is really important. This is the only thing I kind of have mixed feelings about. There's no windows in there. The upside is that, like, I won't get distracted by the weather, you know, or something along those lines. I won't even notice it because everything, but the whole thing is that I'm working towards is trying to create a space in which there's no distraction, in which the possibility of distraction is absolutely minimized. So I can immerse myself completely in what I'm doing. And what I find is that if I don't get time to completely immerse myself in what I'm doing, and if I don't have that work that I find compelling, then I am really not maximizing the value that I can bring to bear for my company, for my client, for myself, for the world. So, you know, I think about, like, how do you, so it's about how you create that space, how you create that environment. And then once you have those conditions for success, all you've got to do is just do the work. You do the work and you immerse yourself in it, and you'd be amazed with what you can come out with and how good you can feel about it. And I think it scratches a unique human need to, you know, do work that's interesting and meaningful and to have your own sense of agency and freedom. And so one of the things I actively think about to myself is, you know, as a leader, or somebody that likes to humor myself as something of one, how do I do my part to create those conditions for my teams? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I try to set out expectations about, you know, this is how I like the meetings to be run. And we've all gotten the dreaded ping from the boss or the boss's boss or, you know, whoever that comes down and sends you the Slack message, or you see the email come up. The reality is that, you know, the vast majority of us that are doing this kind of work, nobody's life's in danger.
Right.
Nobody's going to die if that Slack message doesn't get answered. Right. Nobody's going to, you know, the client's not going to fire you because you don't answer within 2 hours. And now there's exceptions to that. And, you know, there are, if you're in sales, well, you know, maybe that is the case, right? Because a lot of it comes down to accessibility. But and sometimes I've actually had that battle with, you know, a salesperson or two where they're like, oh, I couldn't reach out. I don't have unlimited access to you. And I think some of that is a failing of our modern world where we have all this technology and we have the ability to talk to anybody at any time, anywhere. But, you know, at what cost?
Mm.
At what cost? Because and this is how I always have the conversation when it comes up to people, is, and I try to actually get out ahead of it and tell people proactively, look, like when I'm meeting with you, like April right now, I am 100% engaged and engrossed in this conversation. It would not be fair of me. It would not be right of me to give you anything less than that. And so whatever I'm doing, I try to do it 100%. So if I'm in a meeting, that meeting is going to be organized. There's going to be an agenda. There's going to be a focus. That meeting is going to be clear goals. We're going to recap. I always set the stick. Like there is a certain way to do meetings the right way. And we do the meeting the right way. And then we're done. And even to the point where I read this recently and I'm really chewing on it. You know, sometimes people slip in the, we got done early. You know, here's one more thing. And sometimes I just want to say, no, let's not do one more thing. Let's not do the one more thing. We've already got the thing. And now I'm going to go do that thing. And then I'm going to come back and then we're going to have another conversation. And again, caveats apply, you know, terms and conditions apply. Your individual mileage may vary, but you know, unless you're a senior executive, and even then, you know, you need to create the conditions where you can actually just do the work. And we need to give ourselves the permission to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody is just so, I think some of it's the billable hours thing where, you know, it's like, how could I justify, I like to joke about it's just sitting, I'll tell people, I just need to sit and throw a ball at the wall for a minute and think about this thing. And I've had people ask me questions. I say, you know, it's okay to not have all the answers all the time for everything. That's okay. I tell people, like, I got to think about that one. And sometimes while I'm thinking about it, it sorts itself out. And
for sure.
Great. And sometimes it doesn't. And then I kick myself. But, you know, you'd be surprised sometimes. So I don't know. I think there's a lot there. And I think if we could, you know, well, what's that say? There's like sort of a modern saying. It's like normalize, you know, blank, you know, normalize blank. I want to normalize carving out time for thinking. I want to make it okay for people. I had a conversation with a project manager the other day, kind of a junior PM, newer as a PM. And I said to her, you know, I have to admit, I felt guilty because I had the afternoon cleared and things have been a little bit slow for me. Everybody else is really busy, but I'm like, I just need to do some big picture thinking. I need to step back and I need to kind of think about all the parts and pieces. I need to lay it all down. And I have my own sort of creative process that I like to go through. And anybody that's worked with me kind of knows, like, he's a big pain in the neck because that's just how he is. Don't mind him. You know, he's got to kind of do his thing. But, you know, I went back. I said, I actually feel guilty about this. I felt guilty about doing that. And I had to remind myself that, you know, that's actually my job. That's what my job is, right? Is to think about the big picture and make sure we're moving towards the big picture. If you don't have time to think because you're bouncing from meeting to meeting to meeting, deliverable to deliverable to deliverable, and email to email to email, and you're trying to pack every single second with every little possible thing that you could be. We're human beings, damn it. And sometimes we need to stand up and walk outside. And, you know, one afternoon I had a hard day. And, you know, sometimes I just say, you know, maybe I have only worked 6 or 7 hours today, but, you know, that's all they're getting. Because mm-hmm. I put all I had into that. And I think, again, that's, I don't know what the answer is. It kind of goes back to that, like, well, if I, but I can only bill 6 hours for that. You know, your time card at the end, you got to like make that hour up. But, you know, I also, door swings the other way because I have days where, you know, I'll be going and I'll work nine. Sometimes I'll work 10 hours. If it's something I'm really engrossed mm-hmm. in and going, and it's yeah. like, I'll just rip through it, you know, and I just, and I go from there. So the thing is that like, you got to judge yourself by the results because that's what the client's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if you have 3 minutes before your next meeting or 7 minutes before your next meeting and you've been in back-to-back meetings, stretch your legs, get a snack, get a drink of water, go to the bathroom, walk outside, you know, it's okay. It's yeah. okay.
Yeah, we're not machines.
No, and to me, that's, look, if a client bills me for an hour, you know, usually you're around to the 15 minutes anyway. If you got 6 minutes left from a meeting, bill the last 6 minutes to that meeting because it could just as easily have been spent on the, you know, how's the wife, how's the kids conversation, how's the weather. And those conversations are important. I'm not downplaying those conversations. I think they're incredibly important. But I think that's just as valuable as, you know, closing the email, you know, just walking away for 3 minutes. It's okay. Don't beat yourself up. And my point with that project manager I was talking about is I said all that and she said, that makes me feel better because I felt guilty about doing the same thing. And, you know, that says something about a pervasive sort of mentality. And, you know, that somehow makes us feel like we've got to be busy, but, you know, maybe knock it off a little bit and be a little less busy. Because and just try to, you know, focus on the thing that's the most important. And when you fix it and be done with it. So when you move on from it, because it's these sticky things we don't finish that accumulate. And if you don't have that time to get into a flow state where you just heads down and you're just working, then, you know, you're never going to get ahead. You're never going to get out of front and you're never going to do great work. And I want my team to do great work.
And I think for getting into the flow state or like carving out time for deep work, especially as a project manager, a big piece of it for me comes down to setting expectations with my team and with my client. So I'm on a full-time account where to some extent they do expect us to be available to them because they're paying for us to be on 40 hours a week. It's fixed capacity. And, you know, sometimes I just put on my team status, like, hey, I'm doing deep work on this topic. Like, I'm going to lift my head back up at 11 a.m. or whatever it is.
Yep.
And it took me so long to figure that out. So I was like, as a project manager, I need to be available 24/7. Like, no, I don't. There's barely anything that actually comes through during those deep work times where I'm like, oh my gosh, like that was actually a really big deal and I missed it. There's probably been maybe one in 2 years since I've been practicing deep work, like time blocks that's actually happened. And I don't even know. I'm throwing out one. I don't have anything that I can remember, but, you know, and so I think it's just like setting those expectations. And also like I try to set that environment or how you mentioned, like with the soil, like set that, allow your team to set those expectations too. Like, especially for my dev team where like, they don't need to be getting distracted by their team's messages. No. So I tell them like, You might see that I've messaged you about something, but you don't need to look at it. Like, there's nothing that I could be pinging you about that needs a response in 20 minutes. Like, probably nothing. Maybe 2% of the time it's something that's really urgent. But even then, like, no one's head's going to swivel. Like, it's okay. Finish whatever you're building. Like, I personally like to build in times where this is where I check my email. This is where I check my Jira notifications.
Yeah.
And other than that, I try to stay out of it because it just like I could spend all day. I think especially for PMs, like we could spend all day in our email, all day. And it's really not anything like too important. I don't think.
True story. I check my email once, twice a day tops.
Yeah.
And that blows some people's minds. But I gave myself permission to do it a couple of years ago. And it was a huge game changer because you just get caught in this loop of going back and forth. There's a quote I like. I don't remember where I got it from. I just said it to a client the other day, you know, and he was a really great guy. I'll have to send this to him afterwards. But, you know, we were talking, he said to me, you know, he has a rule that if somebody sends an email and somebody sends an email back and then somebody sends another email back to that, shut it down, have a meeting. Shut it down, have a meeting. Because if you're going to be going back and forth in email, right, it's just, you just need to have a conversation. It's too dynamic of a subject to solve in email. Right. For whatever reason, or the audience is, you know, too dynamic.
I might disagree with that actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I used to be on that thought train. And then I worked for a client that was really big with asynchronous communication.
Oh, I think it has its place. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't feel like I have the line where I'm like, oh, this should be a meeting.
Yeah.
But I do definitely have a lot of situations where I'm like, this meeting could have just been a Slack thread. Like this meeting doesn't actually need to exist. So I don't know about the email back and forth. Like
what I like to do is I'll actually sometimes call the meeting. I will literally put in a subject line meeting in an email because of course I'm prone to verbosity. And so I would, you know, but I'll sometimes give myself permission to go a little bit longer in an email, but I do it and I acknowledge it as a meeting in an email because who wants to go to a meeting that could have just been an email, you know? But then by the same token, and like I said earlier, right? Like if you can save people from having to have a meeting, then great. Because sometimes, you know, I'm all about participative leadership and, you know, getting, you know, consensus, building consensus and so on. But sometimes you just got to like tell people like, damn it, I need your timesheets to be in this format. Or like, you know, like whatever, like, you know, baloney it is that you've got to deal with and you're not expecting a ton of input. Or you just want to share information so strategically people know what's going on. That's perfect for an email. And yes, I think there are probably exceptions. But I would say this, what I said back to him, as I said, a quote I like, which is that, you know, nothing great has ever really happened over email. Mm. Maybe you disagree and that's okay. And I'd be interested to talk about that if you do, but, you know, I personally, for me, I found like, I can't really ever point to a single email that was like, yes, that fixed it. Awesome. You know, it's usually now the conversation gets kicked up, then we move it to a meeting and then sometimes we have some great meetings come out of that. Mm-hmm. But I've actually, what I've found is like, once people start going back and forth, you know, there's a tendency for the conversation to kind of devolve. And I think there's a dehumanizing aspect to email. Cause I've also seen people be, you know, say some things in email that, you know, frankly, I don't think they would say, you know, on a meeting, I do agree that though that, right. I'm also a fan that there's like a matrix of synchronous and asynchronous and like written and verbal. And especially if you're working with offshore teams, you know, especially and/or people that are not native speakers. But even if you're working 100% onshore and everybody's part of the same group in the same culture, People process differently. And,
yeah,
you know,
do.
going back to that psychology thing. And so, you know, I like to look at a diagram, and I like asynchronous personally. Like, you can send me a whole bunch of information, because I love that, because I can queue it up and I can have my deep work time and I can immerse myself into it, and I can reflect and go at my own speed and really be thoughtful. And so I appreciate that, but there's a lot of people that don't, and that's okay. That's not wrong. There's a lot of people that like to talk things out. And I also happen to really enjoy that. Sometimes I'm like, you know, let's just hop on. So I think it all depends on who you're talking about and know. And as I like to say, this is a people business. So you've got to know the people.
For sure. I just think when meetings become the default or emails become the default, because I don't think emails are a great tool of communication. I think when I'm talking about asynchronous, it's, and I don't think Teams is great either. I'm really meaning leveraging something like Slack or, you know, online documents where you can do collaboration, or Jira, things where you can collaborate in real time or not in real time, but kind of at your own speed. I think when we get in a place where meeting is the default,
right,
it just can be dangerous. It's like, do we really need a meeting for this?
Right.
Are we actually getting something done? Or are we kind of just all on here, jibber jabbering away? And
right.
I find especially I'll give you what I consider to be a great example is validating a timeline and a project plan.
Yeah.
You can do that offline. And then it probably does make sense. I like to get on a phone call and just make sure that we're all on the same page and that people, everybody knows what's going on. But I don't want that to be your first time looking at the timeline.
Right,
please
exactly.
Prepare, please look at it and come to the meeting with your questions. Even better, let us know beforehand so that we can build out the agenda of what risks we want to talk about or what questions about what do these deliverables actually mean? What do we want to talk about? So we can have a defined goal for the meeting. Cause I think building consensus that is hard to do offline and asynchronously. Although when I contracted with this one organization, they were amazing. they set the standard. Oh my gosh. And then when the contract ended and I was on, just these other clients, I was like, what? It was so meeting heavy, but I digress.
Yeah.
Well,
there's a good point. There's a great point there. And in that, the question I ask myself a lot is actually, what's the best modality to make this thing happen? And so sometimes that's a meeting, sometimes that's an email. And I sort of have some unwritten rules. I don't know if I've ever consciously articulated, but if I'm going to take an action, if there's some strategic thing we need to do, or, some realization we have to realign the team and mobilize towards a particular, pivot point or something, then sometimes I've started something as an email that became, I've typed out an email and then I've gone over and said, actually, this person's going to have too much to say about it. And this other person's going to have something to say to them. So this needs to be a meeting. And then I've kind of arranged to schedule out the meeting. And then I've realized, actually there's this other person that really needs to be part of that conversation. And then as I realize that, I'm like, well, that person's going to want to know this and I don't know this. So actually, before I do this, I actually need to go talk to somebody else and understand, this thing so that I can take, I know what position I'm going to take. So I can be well armed for that conversation so that, and then sometimes I get into it and I go, I'm overthinking it. And actually it's okay. We're just going to waste a little bit of some people's time here, but we're just going to pull into a meeting. I'm going to throw out a big hairy problem. And I'm going to do the Captain Picard thing where I just say, okay, what recommendations, you know, and I've become a really big fan lately of just one question or one word, you know, questions like recommendations. You know, I'll just ask you like recommendations, options, you know, and just keep it simple. But, you know, I think it's if you, because there's so many different types of problems that we face. And sometimes it is just best to send an email. Sometimes it is best to have a meeting. There is no better method. You know, it's just there. Each is a tool in the tool set. And, you know, like any good craftsman, you know, I want to use the right tool for the job. could so use funny. A hammer for a screw. Could.
Ouch. Shouldn't. Let's not.
Yeah.
That's like when I try to force people to do asynchronous communication. Because yeah. you also have to take a look at like the culture of your team and like their potential or their appetite for change. And like we all have different appetites. It's like, you know, so just working within, not necessarily like bending to the status quo, but meeting people where they're at, right? Yes. And then slowly trickling in, you know, maybe little morsels of changing the modality here or there.
Yeah, so true. So true. And if you want, then, you know, one, anybody that gets into consulting is self-selecting to be part of, to be a change agent. So we've got to also recognize that, you know, we are the kinds of people who embrace change and like rolling on to different projects. And a lot of our clients are not that way, you know, especially in certain industries are have people that are lifers, you know, people working at a place for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And here you come, right? Some stranger that knows very little about them or their mission. And you're a hired gun from the outside. And here you come to just blow up their world and change the way that they do things. And they don't know you. They don't trust you. And that's very scary because they've got a, you know, and their bosses, you know, they may not always have the best relationship with their boss or, you know, or they may not trust, you know, different players within the organization. And so, you know, you've got to be able to build that trust. And I think that it just all comes down to like a fundamental respect. And frankly, I think we tend to, I think it's easy to, especially if you're early in your career, you know, just say, well, you know, this person's boss should take care of it, or, you know, this person just needs to get on board to train, or if they don't like it, they can leave. You know, the reality is actually we need those people. We need those people that know that knowledge. And it's a question of how do you make them, not how you make them, you can't make them. I actually really hate that I use that word. How do you align with them? Right? Mm-hmm. How do you get their fears and their hopes and, you know, all of the stuff that's at play? And you don't have to like them. You don't have to be their friend. And you don't even have to, you know, there's a lot you don't have to do. Mm-hmm. But I think if you just start by just having a conversation, if somebody's, you know, giving you a hard time, just, you know, talk to them about it and say, you know, I feel like there's some friction here. Help me understand what I can do on my part to fix this, right? What can I do on my end to be a better partner to you? Yeah. Have I made a mistake? Have I misstepped? And, you know, whatever they say, you know, just let them say it. And they could be completely wrong. They could be they could be completely right. It doesn't, what you got to be able to pick out is, you know, where are they coming from and what can you do? It's usually between the lines. What's the between the lines? You know, are they afraid they're going to lose their job? They've been here 15 years and you're coming in, you're going to automate their job and take it away. You're going to take what's a full-time job and you're going to cut it down to now 2 hours. What are they going to do with their day? Well, that's a real good opening for a conversation about, well, what would you do with 6 extra hours in your day if we improve this? Mm-hmm. Are there higher value things that you could be doing? Right. Mm-hmm. And the answer usually is yes. And sometimes it's not, and those are difficult conversations, and you know those things happen. But you know, 9 out of 10 times, you know, you can, you know, just, you know, we're here to help people.
Yeah.
And we're not here to sit and, you know, write a bunch of code. That's a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
for sure.
we're not here to just get sign off on deliverables, right? That's a means to an end. You know, we're here to solve problems, and people spend a lot of time at work. We see the people at work often more than we see our own families. So, you know, if we can meaningfully improve their job, we can meaningfully improve their life, you know, their conscious life that they're spending 40 hours a week, you know, doing whatever they're doing. So, you know, it's a privilege. It's a privilege. And it's easy to get caught up in the frustrations and the politics and the, you know, ambiguities and, you know, all the things, and just like set it aside and just remember why you're there. And if you feel like you're in a place where you can't do that, then it's time to take a step back and mm-hmm. it's time to look at other things, you know, mm-hmm. other roles, other projects, even other jobs. It's consulting will always be there. It will always be there. If you need to take a break, take a break. That's okay. You can always come back, you know.
So I know that you gave us one of your quotes, but I always ask at the end if there is a favorite quote out there. Did you want to give us another one? Are you good?
I think my favorite quote that I try to live by is by Henry Bergson. And he says, "Think like a man of action, act like a man of thought." Now strip out the gender overtones, because it's just mm-hmm. true for anybody, right? But it's written, I think, in an older time. But, you know, I think there's a lot there. Think like a man of action, right? So when you're thinking, you got to actually be ideas are nice. And I love exploring ideas more than the average Joe. But you've got to have utility somewhere. You've got to be like, where does this go? But, you know, and there's people I've encountered that have said like, oh, you're too much into the big ideas, you know. But what I actually find is it's those big ideas that inform me on how to achieve the thing. And so if it's not helping you do that, then, you know, you need to move on, and you need to be patient with people that, you know, need to have a framework or have a way of making sense of things. And on the flip side, the reverse is true. When you act, you need to be thoughtful, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's very tempting to just act, but you've got to, you know, I'm all about a word I use a lot is intentional. I want to be intentional about what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and why I'm doing it. And it's not about, you know, it's not about, there is a time, and there's absolutely a time and a place for the spaghetti cannon. Just throw everything you can at the wall and see what sticks. And then, and that's ideation. And that's good. That's great. That's part of creativity is in all the ideas. But then you need to figure out, okay, well, now it's time to act. And you want that action to be decisive, but you want it to be the right move. Is this move going to help you towards your goal? And there's a balancing act there. And if anybody knows the answer to where the right place to be on that is, then please let me know.
Let us know, please. And Charles, if any of our listeners want to learn more about you, where can they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I do have a website I want to relaunch, I think, but yeah, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'd love to talk. If something that I've said has moved you, or if I've made a terrible error, if I've made a grave mistake and am completely backwards and wrong on something, then I would love to hear that, because, you know, I've held some boneheaded ideas in my time. So, you know, I'd love to learn from you and from your perspectives.
Yeah. And me too. That goes for me as well. I love that. Well, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.